underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Guided by the 3,000 letters, hundreds more had been burned between prominent journalist Lorena Hickok and one of the world's most admired women, Eleanor Roosevelt, all photographed and tucked into a pile of worn boxes at the Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park, New York. Amy Bloom's foray into historical fiction brings us White Houses, a book that explores Eleanor's real-life romantic relationship with Lorena. Amy Bloom is the Shapiro Silverberg Professor of Creative Writing at Wesleyan University. Her novels include Come to Me, a National Book Award finalist, A Blind Man Can See How Much I Love You, nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and Lucky Us, a New York Times bestseller. Again, the name of her new novel is White Houses. It is a pleasure to welcome Amy Bloom to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
So we have to start with the obvious question, which is, what brought you to this relationship?
Well, I think two things brought me to the relationship. One was the idea of 3,000 letters in a relationship that in sort of mainstream history books kept being described as a warm friendship. And I thought, that is a very warm friendship. And then I read the letters and I found myself thinking, what would it be like to have been in love and had a passionate love affair and an enduring friendship and see that in all the photographs, your face had been clipped out, which is what they did in the White House. They just snipped her out of the photograph with a pair of small scissors. And I found myself having this wish to return the love story to history, to say, oh, this is not a misunderstanding, this is not a rumor, this is a relationship and a fascinating one. And also to write about the relationship itself, because these were middle-aged women. They didn't expect to fall in love. They certainly didn't expect to find passion in their lives. And it seems to me they had been sort of lost to each other and then found and lost again and found again as an enduring friendship.
One of the things that you realize in the novel is that this is not, it is a secret and yet it's not a secret. It's an open secret. Is that fair to say?
I think that's true. Yeah, I think it is fair to say. I mean, it was not sort of widely known among the American public, certainly. And there might have been journalists who had their suspicions and journalists who were quite sure about the relationship. But if you were part of the intimate social circle of the White House, you were certainly aware of the fact that Lorena Hickok's bedroom adjoined Eleanor Roosevelt's, not was nearby, not was in the hotel down the street, but was right next door with an adjoining door.
So let us talk about the nature of how the relationship developed. They met in 1932. What were the circumstances?
Well, Franklin was running for president. He was governor of New York State, and Eleanor was first lady of New York State. And Lorena Hickok, who had done a bang-up job covering the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, that case was finally resolved. And she needed a break, and I think her editor felt she should take a break. And so he persuaded her to cover Eleanor Roosevelt as sort of a lighthearted and easy assignment.
This is also not a story of love at first sight. They have their moments, don't they, in the beginning?
I think they are very taken with each other, not as they both go to some pains to say, not because either one of them was a great beauty, but because they are both smart, they are both very politically active, they are both very politically interested, and share a lot of common values. And I think for Eleanor, she has tremendous admiration for a professional woman, for a woman who's actually working in this male-dominated field of the newspaper. And I think Lorena has a great admiration for this woman who is unfailingly gracious and interested in the world around her and trying to make a difference.
At what point does the relationship start to mature into an intimate relationship?
Well, they go on a long train trip, and as anybody who's been on a long train trip can attest, they are very conducive to life-changing moments. And they share with each other their stories of their childhoods, both of which are quite difficult, although very different. And I think they begin to see each other as people and as women, and they are very taken with each other. And although, you know, they are not great beauties, they find each other quite beautiful and quite compelling.
And what does, this is how far into the relationship?
Well, Lorena begins covering Eleanor Roosevelt as the possible first lady in the early fall. The election is in November. He is elected. In those days, the inauguration is not until early March. And by early March, Lorena Hickok has moved into the White House and quit her job working for Associated Press and will never work as a journalist again.
And she finds her place within the White House. And talk about that, of her understanding not only of Eleanor Roosevelt, but of Franklin.
Well, I loved writing about the White House because in those days it was really more like a ramshackle boarding house than a great institution. The furniture wasn't in great shape. The drapes weren't in great shape. The menu was horrible. The joke in Washington, D.C. was that if you were lucky enough to be invited for dinner at the White House, you should make sure you have dinner first because the food was so terrible. And, you know, the sense that Lorena is wandering around the White House late at night, bumping into Franklin, was something that really offered some wonderful opportunities. But it is true that there were, at any given time, several people who were not related to the Roosevelts who were living in the White House.
What was her role? What was her official position within the White House at that time?
Well, her initial official position was not part of the Roosevelt family. She was an investigative reporter for the Federal Emergency Relief Agency run by Harry Hopkins, which was to see what the conditions were for Americans in the Depression. And her job was to send back reports, which are still collected in the Library of Congress and which were famously informative and observant and sharp-witted. And she did that for 2 years. She crisscrossed the country. She went everywhere from Arkansas to Missouri to Maine to the Southwest, writing about people's lives under the Depression and what the government efforts were doing to improve their lives and the ways in which those were succeeding and failing.
Amy Bloom is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is White Houses, published by Random House. Talk about the relationship between Lorena and Franklin Roosevelt. That also is a complicated relationship.
Yes, like most human relationships among adults. I think that Franklin was not a fool, and his wife had plenty of friends who were gay and plenty of friends who were, in fact, in couples that had been together for decades. And so it wasn't that he was unfamiliar. It wasn't that he had never met any gay women. In fact, they were really quite prominent in Democratic circles. And at that time, you know, you had Democratic women's associations rather than the way it is now. And a lot of those women in leadership positions were gay and were friends of Eleanor's. I think that he enjoyed Hick. I mean, Hick was, by all reports of people who knew her, very funny, very smart, good company, could, you know, handle her liquor and tell a good story and appreciate a good story and not a shrinking violet. And so she was really excellent company and probably more fun in that sense than Eleanor. I think that both Hick and Franklin appreciated a good story, appreciated a good drink, and appreciated that life was complicated and surprising, and that was not to be avoided.
When you look at the the understanding that he had of Eleanor's relationship. Of course, there is the understanding that she, and I assume Hick, had as well of Franklin's other relationships.
Absolutely. And in fact, it is Eleanor who picks out Missy LaHand, who is a young woman working in Boston for the Democrats, and handpicks her to come and work for the governor and then for the president. And so it is not as if this was something that was thrust upon her or that she was forced to accommodate. In fact, she understood very well what her husband needed and the things that she could and couldn't provide. And one of the things that she said about herself that she couldn't provide was sort of an endless, eye-batting, delighted audience for all occasions. It just wasn't in her and it wasn't her style. And so she found somebody who could do that as well as be a very competent secretary.
So what did they, when I say they, Eleanor and Franklin, so what did they get out of the relationship with each other then? Because they very much needed each other.
I think they did need each other. I think they admired each other a great deal. I think they respected each other's opinions. It was always crushing for Franklin when Eleanor felt that he was not doing enough or not making a genuine effort. You know, Franklin had been really a notorious lightweight until he was governor of New York State. He was not considered a man who really got things done, and he wasn't considered a progressive leader. It wasn't until after he had polio and after he became governor that he really began to take on some of the gravitas and effectiveness that we associate with him now. And I think they saw each other as a team. They certainly shared a political agenda, and they had a system that worked really well politically, which was that Eleanor was always on the left pushing him, and he could always take cover when he had to deal with the right wing, which was very much the Southern Democrats of the time, by sort of saying, oh, well, that's my missus. What do you expect me to do about it? And then sent her on her way to do more of what she had been doing.
Were they protective of one another?
I think they were in a lot of ways protective of each other. I also think that they were both people who understood no one is everybody's cup of tea. We have a free press, and people are going to hate you. And one of the things that was really striking in doing the research for the novel was how similar the really vitriolic hatred of the Roosevelts was to the hatred of the Obamas, with a lot of the same elements and a just sense of shock and betrayal on the part of a lot of conservatives that America should even be allowed to go down this road in which you talk about poverty, you talk about the rights of the disenfranchised, you talk about the need for justice and equality. And there were a lot of people who regarded even that conversation as an infringement on their own rights.
There is also the illness, and Franklin is a very ill man. So there is a protection there, too, an understanding. I mean, that's another secret that is added to this equation, isn't it?
Well, that was an amazing secret. And I feel that the people protecting the Roosevelt presidency took a very clever tack, which was not to tell a big lie, but to tell something that seemed like a small lie, which was to say the president walks with difficulty. And that was a lie. It's like saying I fly with difficulty. Well, like, no, I don't fly at all because I'm not capable of it. And he couldn't walk at all. He could simulate walking. But in fact, he didn't have use of his legs. In every picture of him, he is either holding onto a railing or holding onto an arm or holding onto the back of a chair. And so what they managed to create is the appearance of mobility. But in fact, he had none. He could sort of walk with braces on his legs a few steps, sort of swinging his legs from his hips. And it is really Eleanor and his campaign manager, Louis Howe, who help him recover from the polio psychologically. Even though he is not able to recover physically, despite thousands of dollars spent on warm springs and on all sorts of treatments, none of which changed the polio at all.
You certainly have written historical fiction before, but was this a leap for you in the sense of taking on such giants of American history?
It was, and happily I didn't think about it too much until I was sort of halfway in. I knew that I was not going to narrate the book from Eleanor or Franklin's point of view, that those voices were just too big and too well known. But when I began to feel like I understood who Lorena was and I liked her and I felt that I could sort of enter into her and imagine her, because there was a lot that was not written about her, then I felt like I could enter the narrative and write about these big, big, iconic figures from the point of view of an outsider.
And talk about that voice of Lorena, because it is confident, but it is questioning at times too, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, she grows up dirt poor. She doesn't go to high school right away. She works as a hired girl, which means you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, having slept on the kitchen floor, take care of the babies, make breakfast for the family, run like hell to your classroom. When the 3 o'clock bell rings, you run home, you tidy up the house, you get dinner, you put the babies to sleep, and then you do it all again the next day for about 50 cents a week. And that was her life. She grew up poor. She was always on the side, really, of the working poor, and as she would say, the hired girls of America, which is why she adored Franklin Roosevelt as a president. And she also had her opinions, which were fairly sharp, about the lives of the privileged and what they did and didn't know about the rest of the world.
What went into the framework of figuring out how to tell the story? Once you had the voice and once you had Lorena's voice, you said it in late April of 1945. It's just weeks after the president has died. And then as she's telling the story, it goes back and forth. At what point did you realize that was the way to tell the story?
Well, the initial impulse for that was the idea of the weekend in Eleanor's Washington Square apartment a few weeks after Franklin dies, because, in fact, she clears out the White House in about 2 weeks with a list and a bunch of boxes and some helpers. So 12 years of living in the White House, she wraps it up in a couple of weeks, hands the key to Bess Truman, good luck to you, and she's out. And which is, I think, impressive. But also, she was clearly at loose ends. There's some indication that she does call Lorena. There's nothing to indicate that they spend an entire weekend together. And I thought, you know, these people have been together on and off for 30 years by the time Eleanor dies. And so in 1945, they've been together on and off for about 12 years. And they know each other, and they trust each other, and it isn't always working out as a romance, but there is also a great underpinning and connection. And so I thought, if I were in terrible distress and grief and shock, I would want somebody very close to me to whom I could be my truest and most miserable self, because Eleanor was a great one for putting on a front and behaving herself well. She was raised by a very strict grandmother who said, if you must cry, go into the bathroom and run the taps. Nobody wants to see your tears. Mm. And I think she would have felt that the only person she might have been able to really show her grief and her misery and her loss to would be Hick, because Hick always understood the relationship between Eleanor and Franklin and had to live with it. And also there is the betrayal by her daughter Anna for Eleanor, in which Eleanor has to discover that not only has her husband suddenly died, but the person right next to him, the person holding his hand when he dies, is the woman whose love affair really altered their marriage forever, Lucy Mercer, who was Eleanor's good friend and social secretary in the 20s. And the get-together is arranged by Anna Roosevelt. And so I think it must have been just a terribly, terribly dark and lonely time for Eleanor Roosevelt. And it made sense to me that she would turn to Lorena, who was always there for her.
Mm. Lorena did not attend the funeral.
She didn't attend the funeral. And the pleasure of writing a novel as opposed to a history or a biography is that I can make up my own reasons and my own timing for it. And so I saw her as feeling that that was not going to be that she was not going to be able to really be close to Eleanor and support her. All the kids were going to be there, and all the press and all of the famous people. And I think that always made her a little uncomfortable.
Amy Bloom is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is White Houses. It is published by Random House. You mentioned the poverty that Hick grew up in, and to me that's a great element of the novel, is the contrast between that poverty and, of course, the great wealth that Eleanor grew up in.
Yeah, I think it comes up a lot. And, you know, some novels really focus on issues of class. I mean, I think that in some ways Jane Austen does that as well as anybody else, as, you know, as well as sort of the great American novels of the 20s and 30s, in which those issues are really front and center. And I wanted a character who really appreciates culture and appreciates fancy things and likes a nice soft pillow, especially because she didn't have any of those things, but who also recognizes that there is a gap between, as Lorena says, people who have silver and therefore never bought it, and people who never saw silver.
When you talk about the advantages of writing a fictional account and what that allows you to do, what were the challenges and the moments that you felt, and maybe I don't want to put words into your mouth, but that you felt frustrated as to wondering how this would have worked out between the two?
Oh, you mean in my imagination,
yes,
how it could have gone between them?
Yes.
Oh, I think that's the joy and the grief of writing a novel, which is you have your characters and you see where the story is going to take them and where they themselves are going to take them. And there's a way in which even when you've made up your characters, you also understand that character is destiny. And even if they are entirely fictional, you recognize that once you have created these human beings, you cannot suddenly make a very serious person be all lighthearted and giggly for the next 20 years, because it doesn't make any sense. And so in being true to the characters as I understood them and as I created them, it was heartbreaking to see that they would not be able to make their lives together, which had nothing to do with how much they loved each other, but also, as in real life, has to do with the other things that they love as well.
Another way, and probably a better way, of asking that question is, did history ever get in the way of the good story?
Well, no, because it's a novel. So,
right.
I was very careful to say in a note in the book that this is a novel. It's a work of fiction from beginning to end. I have worked from the facts of geography and the facts of chronology. For example, it's a novel. I could have made the Depression occur in 1965, but I didn't. I could have made Eleanor Roosevelt into a wild blonde showgirl from Vegas who married up, but I didn't. I chose to work from, you know, the actual facts without assuming that all would be dictated by the actual facts as they had been understood and reported. So even with actual facts, there's a lot of room for imagination if that's what you want to do.
The novel is White Houses. Is there significance in the title?
There were multiple White Houses in their life. There is the White House of Washington, D.C., the house in Warm Springs, Georgia, which was sort of a southern White House for Franklin, was a White House. Lorena has a small rented white cottage on Long Island that is her retreat. And I felt that, as it turned out, there was more than one center in the course of their relationship, but that the two of them moved through each of the White Houses.
Amy Bloom's new novel is White Houses. It is published by Random House. Amy, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much.
Be well. Amy Bloom's new novel is White Houses. It's published by Random House. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
Every letter. that you send me. I read a dozen times or more.